Welcome to Novel Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. There are just three things I ask of you, if appropriate to you and your experience. Please subscribe, please click on the like button, and please share this program link with any family members, friends, or colleagues who might be interested or benefit from the content. Now, on with our program. In the spotlight is Boo Walker and some dude named Benjamin Blackmore. I am thinking that maybe that name came from Ritchie Blackmore, the famous guitar player of Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow and Sodom, but we'll find out. Boo's going to answer a lot of questions. He's joining us from the state of Maine, and we're going to talk about him, his alter ego, his nom de plume. Benjamin Blackmore is a pseudonym he uses when he's writing thrillers, but then he writes under his own name when writing about a mountain in particular. We're going to learn all about that mountain and where it exists. It may only be in the, you know, the firmament of his imagination, which is makes him a writer. That's what it's all about. That's what we do. We have imaginations. We take the real and we turn it into the what would you say? Maybe otherworldly or super real or supernatural or preternatural. Boo Walker, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you. And you've been doing a little moving around. You're in the state of Maine now, but you were in Valencia, Spain for a while. And I think you were running or working on a vineyard. Is that right?
No, that was previously before Spain. I am a nomad. I've learned to accept. And grew up in South Carolina, moved to New York, then to Tennessee, to Seattle, back to South Carolina, then to Washington State when I got where I started a vineyard, and then to Florida, St. Petersburg, and wrote a book in St. Pete, and then decided to move to Spain with my family. So did that and wrote a book called A Spanish Sunrise, which I just saw the cover and I'm excited about. It comes out in August.
So this is the latest one then. Now, is this a novel or is it nonfiction?
This is a novel. Everything's a novel, but yeah.
All right. Good to know.
And now I just moved to Maine last month.
Yeah. And I was joking that you probably could throw a stone and hit Stephen King's mansion, but you were saying you haven't made it up to Bangor yet. And but looking forward to that. So let me ask you about this nomadic lifestyle you're living. What does that do for you?
You know,
And how torturous is it for your wife and kids?
Yeah, my wife is also a nomad. And so we just, you know, before we even have unpacked boxes, we start talking about excitedly where we could go next. We just love the getting to know new people and new restaurants and have new side trips to do and stuff. And really a lot of it is based on my writing and how important setting is for me. And I love the idea of landing in a new place and breathing in this different air and writing about it and having access to all this. That being said, I've got a little bit of Stephen King and John Hughes, who wrote all the Chicago suburb movies, in me, in that I kind of want to settle down and start setting my novels in the same place for a while, which is what we've promised our son.
There you go. Your son is how old now?
He's 8, and he kind of wants a normal life where he can build some roots and stuff.
He's getting tired of saying goodbye to friends, and he's at an age now where there's some connection going on, and he wants some sustainability. So you literally have moved to places where you decided I'm going to write. This is going to be the locale for this novel.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's just, and the Europe thing really came from, I feel like it was a rite of passage for me as far as my heroes, Pat Conroy and Anthony Doerr and Amor Towles, all those guys, every one of them did stints in Europe. And I just felt like I needed to have my European year or two, you know?
Yeah. You know, I visited the American Bar in Paris because for no other reason than Hemingway and others hung out there, and it still has the vibe, I think. So I get it. I get that whole sensation of walking in some of the tracks that have been laid before us, especially these literary tracks. So you're in Maine now, And you said, as soon as we, you know, before we really unpack, we think about our next place. It sounds like Maine may be a mainstay for a while. Or are you thinking, I mean, if it wasn't for your 8-year-old, if he said, you know, Dad, I got the wanderlust like you do, and I just realized that, what would your next locale be? Have you and your wife discussed where you'd like to be post-Maine?
I think we've promised our son until he goes to college that we'll stay here in Cape Elizabeth. But we're already talking a little bit about becoming snowbirds like my in-laws and maybe being able to sneak down into the British Virgin Islands or somewhere in the Caribbean when it's super cold. You know, that might give us a little, that might tamper that nomadic instinct in us a little bit. But I think ultimately we might end up back in Spain or Italy. But I don't know. It'd be nice to establish some roots and really have friends that we don't have to say goodbye to. That's the hardest part of moving.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I'm not sure that's ever going to go away because you're a former banjoist and songwriter in Nashville. Musicians, I mean, ideally when a musician becomes fully realized, they're on the road. They've got a tour, hopefully a big tour with, you know, 80 U.S. cities or going right overseas and whatnot. So that sounds like it might be in your blood. So you've been a songwriter and then you parlayed that into writing novels, but I believe you said, and I'm not sure where I saw this, did you sustain a hand injury that made you give up the banjo?
Yeah, not necessarily an injury, but something, more of like a disorder, something called focal dystonia, which would take an hour to explain, but basically I lost pure, really effective control of my index finger. When I was playing music in Nashville, I was in a band called the Biscuit Boys playing banjo in 2001. The Biscuit Boys, yeah, we played.
And you were, and this is the hand that that works the fretboard.
No, the other one. But
the other one,
right? Okay. So I was a three.
Can't
finger.
You operate with a pick though? Without the
that
or
would
are
be
you an all finger player?
I was three finger banjo style, which is kind of what we did. And to switch to a pick would be kind of playing more Celtic style and. Certainly not something I could have done quickly, and so I went through a bit of a deep valley of life. I mean, that was
imagine
that was what I was going to do, and once I started,
I can imagine what that was like. Yeah, so you had to have been crestfallen because you know that was going to be your life. And what kind of songs did you write? Were they country? And I don't want to sound stereotyped because there's all kinds of music in Nashville. It's not just a country place. But what kind of – were you writing love ballads? Were you writing songs?
Right. That's a good question. We were all music majors, classical and jazz majors at the College of Charleston. And we hit it big in Charleston and said, we got to go to Nashville. So we were playing – bluegrass, but what you would call newgrass. So there was more complicated chords and rhythms, and
we were smoking a lot of dope. Newgrass.
That's right.
Homegrown grass, and okay.
We were trying to bust the stereotypes of playing country music and doing something more, bringing rock and roll and more forward thinking stuff. And stop. We didn't always sing about mamas and trains and, you know, drinking beer.
More fusion style. You were taking a couple different genres fusing them. Rock jazz fusion is probably my favorite music that's out there. But what about the lyrics? Were you the songwriter? Were you writing the lyrics or was that a group effort?
And myself and a guy named Scott Simontaki. We were, we met in Charleston, and he was my first really deep interaction with someone who had a creative soul like I've never known before. And when we started hanging out and playing music, we just became brothers very quickly, and we started writing. And so we wrote most of the songs, and I still keep in touch with him, and I wish we were still writing songs together. But we wrote them together and would bring them to the band, and then the band would generally add, you know, their own ideas to it.
So when you decided that the music career needed to be shelved, had you thought about being a novelist prior to that? Or was it in that moment, and I'm sure that you went through a process, but did you go through a process where you decided, I love to write and this makes a lot of sense for me to just go ahead and parlay the skills I have for songwriting into writing books?
Good question. I was, the earliest memory I have is when I was regarding this feeling of writing was I remember closing Nelson DeMille's book, Plum Island, when I was 17. I was hiking across Ireland as my kind of graduation present for my parents. And I was in sitting down in Waterville, right outside this pub, reading Plum Island. And I closed it and I was like, this guy, John Corey, this character, this is the greatest, most entertaining reading I can remember. And he's so sarcastic and funny. I
love that guy.
You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, it's just unbelievable.
When I read your titles, I thought there are two authors I thought of. One was Pat Conroy, and the other was Nelson DeMille. And then you did something on your website that I wish more people would do. You have that section of books that you love, and you have them divided between self-help and fiction and writing books. And I saw a lot of stuff on there that resonated with me. But that's exactly, and then I thought John Corey is probably, Benjamin Blackmore is probably John Corey's cousin in a sense.
That's,
I mean,
right.
What is that? Did you see, obviously you liked John Corey, who is the, is he actually, I'm trying to remember whether he's a government agent or is he a law enforcement, like a detective? He's a government agent, isn't he?
He's, when he starts out in Plum Island, which was the first book, he's NYPD and he's on leave for being shot. And then he moves through, you know, several different federal agencies through the course of the books. And he's just awesome.
My favorite book, though, with John Corey is Nelson DeMille, is the one about he's the terrorist.
The lion or something.
It's called The Lion or The Lion's Something. Yeah, it's fantastic. I'm not a big reader of pop novels, but that's just written at such a level. It's so well done, and the whole, it's deeper than your typical, paperback novel you'll find at an airport or at a Walmart. So, your influences have been good ones. And Pat Conroy writes beautifully, obviously. He's a beautiful writer. I was a beautiful writer, God rest his soul.
He is, he's probably my, I don't even want to say influence because I am not worthy of, his worst sentence, but we both come from South Carolina. And when I read his books, I started to realize, oh, I love Nelson DeMille and I love thrillers, but I love this idea of not necessarily having guns and special agents and police. And that's why I slowly started to move into writing more book club fiction because I liked getting more into the heart of things and not always writing chase scenes like I do with the Benjamin Blackmore books.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you about. The first, did you start writing as Boo Walker or was your first novel as Benjamin Blackmore?
So I started writing as Boo Walker and I wrote thrillers. And then when I decided that I was going to really change genres, I moved my thrillers to a pen name, to Benjamin Blackmore.
Oh, okay, so you reflagged them under your pseudonym or your pen name, your thriller name. Was Ritchie Blackmore? I mean, where'd you get Blackmore?
Blackmore,
were you a Ritchie Blackmore fan?
I am a Ritchie Blackmore fan, and to my wife's chagrin, I just love electric guitar in general, and I just shake the house every single day when I play. But the actual root of it is I found out years ago that my great 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 uncle, something of that level of great, was R.D. Blackmore, who wrote a book called Lorna Doone, set in Exeter, England. And it was a major piece that influenced Robert Louis Stevenson and tons of people. And so I have a first edition of that. And so I feel this connection and I'd like to think maybe I got a little bit of his genetic makeup. So that's where the name Blackmore came from. And then my brother's name's Benjamin. So.
Good call. So there you are in Nashville. Life changes. You work your way west to Washington State. You're by the Yakima River, and you bought a gentleman's farm. And I've heard the term gentleman's farm before, and I actually looked it up, and it's like a farm that's worked for pleasure. Was that the case there, or was that a vineyard? I thought I heard you say
it was,
vineyard in Washington.
So we bought 4 acres on the river that was already a proper farm. It had nut trees, fruit trees, a huge garden, and then a ton of lawn. And I ripped up a lot of the lawn and planted about 750 grapevines and started making wine too. So what we had was a whole lot of work that didn't produce any money. But what we could do is we would, we had a U-pick, we turned it into a U-pick farm, and we would trade, and we'd be able to give, you know, cases of wine to our friends. And we turned it into a bit of an animal sanctuary, brought in sheep and ducks and chickens and the whole bit. So it was, it was a working farm, but it wasn't for money. It was just, you know, it was probably
pleasure.
For pleasure, and also probably for my research into my series that still pays the bills today, which is my Red Mountain series. And that's based on Red Mountain, where the farm was. And it's centered around.
So there is a Red Mountain there. There is a Red Mountain there?
Yeah, exactly. I live right on the edge of it.
And you've done three. Is it three Red Mountain books or is it four? Three?
Three, and then a prequel that takes place in, starts off in Vermont.
So talk about the mountain, Red Mountain, and you have built entire novels around this mountain. It reminds me, you know, it immediately made me think Cold Mountain, which was a huge seller, but it was a really long book. It was even made, I think, into a movie or a miniseries or something like that. What about that mountain inspired not just a book, but three, really four novels?
Yeah, and I'd like to think, and counting, because I've got a new one just stirring in my head for some point when the time is right. But I got the wine bug about it is kind of shortly after I got the bug to write a novel. And so I moved out west, and I was deciding between California and Oregon and Washington. And I had been drinking wines from this family called the Hedges for a long time. So I went and visited Red Mountain because of that. And as soon as I pulled up, it was like, this is so different than anything I've seen. And it's not Napa, and it's not super well known, and it just feels right. And I'm going to move here. So I moved out there, didn't know anybody, and knocked on the Hedges door and said, I want to learn everything about wine. And they said, you're crazy. And I kept knocking on the door, and they ended up putting me in the vineyard, making minimum wage. And I just worked out in the fields for a year to prove myself. And then they brought me into the winemaking facility and started teaching me that stuff. And at the same time, I had bought this gentleman's farm and was working that as well. I would basically take what they were teaching me and move it over there. And what I found,
what grapes were you growing? And I'll get back to that, what you found, but what grapes were you growing and crushing on your gentleman's farm?
Sure. So in general, it's a Cabernet Syrah, Merlot area, Red Mountain is, but I was looking for something a little bit different. So what was we had Chenin Blanc, and then something called Napa Gamay, and which is actually Valdiguier. And then we planted Sangiovese and one other white. Was it? I can't remember what the other white is at the moment. Maybe Sauvignon.
Nice.
And we were just making some farmer blends, and I was doing it biodynamically and making them in amphora. And it was super, super fun.
There's nothing like drinking a good glass of red wine and reading a novel. So, I mean, they go hand in hand. So, and what you learned was, I cut you off. What you learned was what?
Oh, so what I learned, when you live out in the middle, this is Eastern Washington State, so you're 3 hours from Seattle, and it really is farmland. And in this case, it's actually hops and vines. So it's people who like to indulge in alcoholic beverages or who have that passion. Including myself, I just had the wine bug, but I also love great beer too. But it takes a certain kind of person to dedicate their life to living in the middle of nowhere just to be around the best vineyard land. And I started meeting people that you just can't make up. You know, they were all so darn interesting. And we would have dinner parties, and I'd look around the room and just think, there is not a boring person in this whole crew. And if I could write a book about all of them, and all of a sudden it was like, all right, I don't want to write thrillers. I want to write about people like this, normal people, and I want to give them, I want to knock them down to their knees and see if they can get back up and climb out of it. And I want to set them all here on Red Mountain. So a lot of it was people I met and kind of throwing them into a mix and creating these characters with bits and pieces of each other. So when some of my friends read it, they're like, I know where that came from, you know, these idiosyncrasies and stuff.
So you don't need to be on the scene anymore to write about Red Mountain. You've been thoroughly steeped in that area. And so you can be in Maine and write about Red Mountain, maybe make a trip there occasionally to just reinfuse yourself. Is that the case that you know, you don't feel like you need to be there anymore to write about it?
I think that's the case. I was there a long time for, you know, probably a decade. But you know, I've written, I'm about to start my fourth book since I left the Red Mountain series, now that I'm working with a publisher called Lake Union. So I may have to fly back over there once I decide to write a fourth Red Mountain, just to, you know, get my hands in the sand again.
It makes sense. Yeah. Well, travel period. A lot of people, myself included, find that to be really inspiring, just in terms of brain stimulation and getting the writing going in a way that being sedentary does not. But now you've chosen to be in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. How did that come about? Because you picked various places. Maine, I think, was voted by Interstate Truckers on more than one year to be the most beautiful state in the country. You know, a lot of people don't go to Maine because it's so far away.
Right.
They don't realize how beautiful it is. What was your intent with Cape Elizabeth? Was that any particular agenda?
This was, this all started because my second book for my publisher, in my two book deal that I finished last year, was a book called The Singing Trees. And it was a story that I knew was going to take place up north somewhere. When I say up north, I was in Florida at the time. So I knew it was going to be like Virginia or north. And I had been to Maine a little bit, and I thought, God, I would love to go spend some time in Maine and really get to know it. And that can be where I set The Singing Trees. And so my wife and I flew up here to Portland. Never been here before, and we're absolutely floored. It was like the food scene is made up of a bunch of chefs that can't afford rent in Boston and Manhattan anymore. So they come up here, and all the good music comes up here because it's, you know, Bill Frisell and a lot of these jazz guitarists that I love. It's just a few hour train ride to come up here on tour. And so they play at these really intimate venues, and the scenery is extraordinary. And then somebody told us, actually a friend that I hadn't seen in 25 years reached out and said, I live right over the bridge in Cape Elizabeth. And we came over here, which is where the most famous lighthouse is. And it's along the sea, and there's beautiful houses and this neighborhood feel. And my wife and I looked at each other and we were like, you know, if we are going to really settle down for 10 years, and as we promised our son, we should consider this. So it really stuck with us. And as we went to Spain, we were just looking at houses and waiting for the right time. So it all started because of a research trip, really.
So what's the size of Cape Elizabeth and what's it closest to? Is it close to Portland?
It's I can see Portland from Cape Elizabeth. Yeah.
Okay.
It's almost a suburb. God, I'm embarrassed to say. I don't even know. I mean,
what about the greater Portland area?
Yeah.
Do you happen to know that?
I think it's probably a 500,000. Portland's 80,000 in the city.
So it's a respectable, that's a respectable size. I mean, you certainly have plenty of activity. And like, as you're saying, you've got great cuisine, you've got music. And so on. What about Valencia, Spain? Tell me, why did you go to Valencia? I mean, who doesn't want to go to Spain? But why specifically Valencia, and what book came out of that, or books?
Sure. My wife and I knew from kind of the moment we met years ago, 12 years ago, I think, that we wanted to go abroad. And she's Italian. And so we were thinking Italy, and then kind of at the last minute, I think we just started realizing that both of us, our Spanish was better than our Italian, in my case at least. And I really wanted my son to learn Spanish. And I don't know, Spain is a little bit ahead of Italy as far as economy and healthcare and stuff. And we thought if we're going to stay here for a long amount of time, let's start with Spain. And we knew Barcelona and Madrid were a little big. And we kind of started just talking to people who were saying, don't tell anybody, but Valencia is where you want to be. And we were booked to go right when COVID hit, and we were going to go scout it out. And then we had to obviously cancel the trip. And so as COVID started to consume us, we said, well, what are we going to do? And we just said, let's do it anyway. So sight unseen, we moved to Valencia, and it was
nice.
It just ended
up. I hadn't even actually seen it, but you probably look at Google images and you knew if you're going to be in Spain, it was going to be good living.
Right. We wanted to be near the Mediterranean, and they had their own wine region, and it was an easy, fast train to Madrid, Barcelona. And there's a great airport with Ryanair. I mean, we were, you know, there were $44 tickets to Naples, Italy from Valencia and stuff. It was just...
That's amazing.
Just a dream. So I kind of knew, I don't know if you've ever seen a book or a movie called A Good Year with Russell Crowe.
Yeah. Is that where he inherits a vineyard, but it looks like he has no interest in it.
Yes,
until
exactly.
He's there. Yeah. That was actually a good movie.
I just loved it. And so this, I knew I was going to do something like that. But I didn't want to do a vineyard book because I had already, you know, been writing the Red Mountain series. What I decided I wanted to do was do an olive orchard book. And I've been really into olive oil ever since traveling to Italy years ago. So part of this was a friend of mine who's a olive oil specialist in Manhattan set me up with some really big time, you know, not big, famous authentic producers in Spain. And so I knew I was going to set something on an olive orchard, and it was going to be about an American guy, kind of like the Russell Crowe character from England in A Good Year, that was a complete wreck, a workaholic, and who, you know, goes to Spain, and by the end of the trip is a completely changed guy. And so from the moment I landed, that was what I was working on, and I got to know some really awesome olive oil producers, and I was able to really inject, to me, a more authentic voice because I was there while I was writing it, as opposed to, oh, I'm going to write this book in the community of Valencia, and I'm just going to Google pictures to try to set the setting, you know? And
right.
That wouldn't have worked. Not the same. For me, anyway. Some people are phenomenal at it. I'm sure Stephen King could set a book in Charleston, South Carolina and nail it without going there, but...
Right.
Well, I like to be there.
From another dimension anyway. So.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So for our listeners, there is a link in the episode notes to Boo's website, but I do want to run through just the titles of his novels. So when he's writing under the name Boo Walker, among the books he's written are Red Mountain, Red Mountain Rising, Red Mountain Burning, there's the Red Mountain series, A Marriage Well Done, The Singing Trees, which you just alluded to a little bit ago, An Unfinished Story, which sounds like a bit of a cliffhanger, and then the Benjamin Blackmore books, which are thrillers. And these are the titles that made me think not just Nelson, but also, one of them is called Low Country Punch. So I thought Low Country, that sounds like Pat Conroy. Off You Go is another title. And then Once a Soldier. Once a Soldier could easily be also a Pat Conroy title as well. But yeah, the fact that it's thrillers. And then when I saw Nelson DeMille on your list of books, I thought, I bet John Corey has played a role in your life.
A big
now
one.
You say, yeah, I bet. And he's a cool dude. I mean, to our listeners, if you haven't read any Nelson DeMille, John Corey is just the kind of character that you want to see in movies as well. I don't know that they've ever made any movies out of.
They've tried. It's just been teased over and over. He's sold the options a few times and it just hasn't worked out yet.
Yeah. It's hard to get any kind of movie made. So here's a statement you made. There's no reason anybody can't write 2,000 words a day. And you actually gun for 3,000 words a day, which means that 100,000 word novel takes you just 33 days. I mean, just in terms of volume, obviously
yeah.
You're not writing 3,000 or 2,000 words and saying, hey, every word is polished and I'm going to keep it. That's a big target. Talk about your writing regimen. How do you talk about your process, where you write, how you write? Give us some insight.
Sure, absolutely. Well, the first thing I think about is it's all relative, because I joined a group called NINC, and I started, which was actually when I was living in St. Pete. They had their yearly meeting down the road from my house, and I started meeting a lot of indie authors, including some that just had huge word counts. One in particular writes 7 to 10 a day, and it's just what he does. And sometimes he uses some, speaks through a microphone, and most
which
of the time.
What's 7 to 10? 7 to 10,000?
7 to 10,000 words a day.
Wow. So he's doing a bit of, and this might be you too, he's doing at least a bit of stream of consciousness. He knows what he wants to write about, and he's letting it rip.
That's exactly right. And once I started reading that, hearing these stories of a lot of people certainly hitting 4 to 5 a day, I started to think, oh my God, you know, I've always just had this Hemingway mentality, which is like, you just cut your wrist and bleed onto the keyboard or the page. And I started to remove that. And I started to think, you know, it's easy. I'm trying too hard. I'm putting too much left brain edit mine into it. And you're right. I started to let it become more stream of consciousness. Now, yeah, you're right. In 1 month, I could write a novel and it would be the worst novel in history, because the editing is where I really get in there. So typically, actually, it's a good time to talk about it, because I'm about to start a new book here probably next week. I've pitched a couple new story ideas, and I'd like to think that my publisher's going to like one of them at least. So the first thing I'll do is probably spend a week or two just doing a lot of walking and imagining the character and stepping into the skin of the character and just imagining what they're like and get their tone. I think that's so important. And at the same time, I'll be doing some research around whatever story they choose, kind of around the character's profession and whatever topic I'm doing, and start looking for plot ideas. And then I will sit down and certainly start to outline. And I knew you were going to ask kind of the writing process, and I was thinking about it. And I wish, in a perfect world, that I could just have the same process every time. And that's what I used to set out to do, is I'm just going to get to a process, and then I'll just, you know, cut them out like cookies. But I've learned that there's never the same process. I'd like to outline everything, but in the past couple books, I've only been able to outline to the midway point, and then I don't know what's going to happen. And as opposed to just banging my head against the wall going, come on, Boo, where's the climax? What are you doing? I just typically just start writing the beginning and hoping that, you know, once I get to the end of what I have outlined, things will make sense. Now, I really am. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that that's very much, I think, kind of typical of, you know, where you're going with the story, although you don't know how it ends, and you get to maybe about the midway point and it reveals itself to you. You know, I remember telling my wife, you know, I really feeling good today because I know how this story is going to end now. You leave room for organic development of the story. You let the characters drive it somewhat and not put a straitjacket on the whole thing.
Yes, exactly. And that's what I think. I mean, sometimes you can write just 4 or 5 chapters and all of a sudden see what the ending's like, but you got to get in there and start writing. At least I do. Now, the challenge that I'm facing lately is with my publisher. They're pretty hardcore in that, you know, we'll probably sign a deal in the next week or two, and then I'll have something due August 1st. So that's not a lot of time to write write the way I would like to and put everything I'd like to into it, especially when I start to wander sometimes with my writing. I'd rather have every chapter outlined perfectly so I can really hit my deadlines perfectly. So that's the only thing that I do want to clean up, so I can stick to a book a year. I'd like to not delete as much as I do, because sometimes I'll think I know where I'm going and I'll write it out just to see. And then I'll say, no, that didn't feel right. And I've probably the last 2 books, I've probably deleted 100,000 words for 120,000 word novel. So I'm deleting half of what I write, you know?
Yeah, but that's not a bad, I mean, what you're talking about here, I mean, we talk about stream of consciousness, but what we're really talking about is channeled stream of consciousness, because you know what that chapter is going to be about. You know, kind of what you want to say. So you just dive into that and yeah, it's stream of consciousness, but it's all aimed at a target. It's not like I got to get the laundry done today. And why did we never move to Naples? Or, you know, you're not letting your mind just wander. You're keeping it targeted. And part of the deal, part of the compact, really, when you decide I'm not going to write like Hemingway, which is torture, which is, you know, he might wait an entire day, sit on a piece of paper and a pencil an entire day until the sentence comes to him. Well, the opposite of that is that kind of channel stream of consciousness, letting the subconscious mind have its day. Because when you, I'm sure this is the experience you've had, Boo, is when you allow yourself the freedom to just write and not be an editor at the same time, and you create a volume of word count, you get the best stuff out of that, but you have to throw a lot of dross away. I mean, that's just part of the deal. And so there's diamonds in the rough. Or is that not your experience?
That's 100% my experience. I am such a firm believer that there are two parts of me that write. And one is the ego. And that ego is concerned with, hold on, is this going to get bad reviews? Or is this gonna create enough suspense? Or is this gonna, you know, thinking in the future with almost like a fear-based kind of writing, you know, is this gonna pay the bills next year? Or are my readers not gonna like it, that kind of thing? And then there's the real subconscious me, which is, I think, is the part that is the more, well, certainly the more talented and more plugged in. And the more of that subconscious that I can get working, the better, because that's not even me at all. It's me plugging into whatever magic is out there in the universe that gives all creatives their juice. So I've really become, you know, back to talking about process, I really have come to treat my writing as a ritual where I take some time at the beginning of the morning to really plug in and to speak to my subconscious and speak to my ego and say, okay, we're just going to get in here. No expectations. Don't worry about reviews. Don't worry about that kind of thing. Let's just have fun and let's just see what comes out. And that's how once I'm feeling in that joyful, happy place, I know this is getting a little esoteric, but once I'm in that place, then I start writing. And it's all about letting the subconscious write as opposed to letting anything else lead, because that's where the good writing comes.
Yeah. And that's where you, you know, you hear writers who say, you know, when you're in the groove or you've tapped into the muse, when it's not that you're writing as much as you're reading, your fingers are going and you're reading what's coming out. You're not even consciously thinking about it. It's obviously the subconscious mind at work or something ethereal. You say not to get too esoteric, but I think writing is esoteric. Writing, good writing is esoteric. It tends to be magical. It tends to be something that at its best, it comes almost from another dimension that we're tapped into. And that's all, you know, that's all fine and well. You know, the other thing that you mentioned, which I'm glad you did, because I've written blog posts about this, I've done a video about it, is well, you talked about walking. You walk. You think about the characters, you think about the story, you try to wrap your head around the new project you're going to be working on. And it's antithetical to creativity that we sit in chairs, sedentary, and write, when that basically does not create the kind of brain stimulation that we really need. Movement does that.
Oh, yes.
Whether you're pacing in a room or you're walking, you know, hiking the Red Mountain, whatever it might be, I think there's a lot of people who never put physicality and writing together, but I would encourage anybody out there that what you do, taking that walk and just thinking, because again, not only does it activate creativity, but as long as you let those ideas incubate, they develop just as a child or, you know, ideas germinate. But you got to focus on it. Once you focus on it, it expands more quickly if there's some physical activity that stimulates more brain activity. Not to get too biological.
No, you and I see very eye to eye on this kind of thing. It's that whole idea that your best ideas come to you in the shower. I mean, I'm so leaning on my subconscious these days. I guess that's the best word for it. That what I'll do is I'll say, okay, I'm facing a problem right now. You know, I can't decide whether to set this book in the 80s or the 90s or something big like that. And I'll actually kind of speak to my mind and say, you know what, I'm just go to work on that and I'll get back to you. And I'll kind of say, I'm going to go for a long walk and just, hey, subconscious, go to work on that and get back to me when you can. And I'll just go quiet and I'll go walk and think about other things or play the guitar. And then maybe a day or an hour or whatever later, the answer comes to me as sure as anything. You know, you don't even need to question the answer. And I think it's such an American mindset. I hate to pick on American because I've been in Spain, but this is why I went to Spain. Is it's such an American mindset to do work all the time and busy work. And for us to sit at our computer and work for 9 hours. And if you're working from home, they're like tracking your keyboard swipes and stuff like that or whatever, where I think taking space to be creative and allowing your creative mind to work, whether that's going to play ping pong or taking a nap, that is just as important, you know, and I love what comes out of that. And as soon as I started giving myself permission to not always be typing to consider it work, then I started becoming also more efficient and also more creative.
So if you're making a living writing novels, which is what everybody wants to do and almost nobody achieves, what do you do marketing-wise to get the sales of your books going?
Great question. Well, I started out self-publishing. I started out and I had a agent in New York, and I thought that my first book, Low Country Punch, was just going to make me an instant millionaire. And as soon as we were so close to a deal with Bantam Dell, and that fell through, and we started chasing some other stuff, and it just didn't pan out. Actually, the editor who said yes ended up leaving while I was doing a last minute edit for him, and it was just all the wind out of my sails. So I ended up saying, I'm just going to self-publish this. And I did it and released it. And I still was like, okay, I'm going to be seven figures here in the next few weeks. And it kind of released to a thud. And I just said, or I'm just going to do what everybody says, which is start writing another. And it's the best advice I ever got. And so my mindset was, if I feel like writing, I need to write. And if I'm tired of writing, that's when you market. So I wrote a couple more books, the thrillers, just as fast as I could. And then I wrote Red Mountain. And that was about the time that I started researching AMS ads, AMS advertising, which is, you know, how you can basically do sponsored ads on Amazon surrounding other books on Amazon. And I got pretty good at it. And that was where I started. And that's where I got some attention. And that's where I finally broke in the top 100 with Red Mountain, which is a big deal for me, a big deal for anybody. So I still do that to this day on my self-published stuff. I spend a lot of money every day on Amazon advertising. Maybe I'll dabble with some Facebook advertising down the line. I have some and I've lost a lot of money. I haven't mastered it. So what I mean is maybe I'll put enough effort into it where it'll stick. But for now, I spend all my advertising money on that. But the blessing with working with Lake Union, I'm just starting my fourth book for them, is I haven't had to do that level of marketing. You know, they pay for the audio and the print and editing and everything. And, you know, of course I want to maintain an online presence and, you know, get out there, but I don't have to spend money on advertising. And so that's been a kind of a nice break, because really I want to up my writing game, and that's what this has given me. So I can spend more time reading novels and reading craft books and just studying the craft. I'm a geek for the craft. I'm probably too much so. Sometimes I get a little over analytical. But that's my advice to up and coming writers is you got to learn how to do it on your own. And it seems to me the best way to do that is learning how to do advertising on Amazon and Facebook.
Now, your early self-published books, were they, I noticed there's, you have audio and you have eBooks. Are they also print books when you first published?
I did everything.
Stick only with eBooks?
No,
you did everything. Okay.
Yeah.
I see. So let's step back in time again. You had talked about this a little bit, but I saw that, I'm not sure where I picked this up, but you say that you went into a tailspin after the music thing exploded on you. Talk about that tailspin and how you emerged from that. How did you?
Sure.
What was that? What was the nature of the tailspin, and how did you get out of that?
Well, I was a pretty troubled teen growing up. I had such a perfect family growing up, and I was given all these opportunities, and I was such a rebel and just a headache for my parents. And I don't know why. I mean, I just had something to say and wasn't able to say it. And when I finally got the banjo in my hand, for one, I found this outlet to let it all out. It was like I had this tremendous amount of energy running in me. And as soon as I was able to start playing, I was able to directly run it through the banjo, and it was unbelievable. But something also unhealthy crept into it, which was, as I started to, you know, play on stage and our band started to become big, I really associated my worth as a person based on, you know, how good I was at the banjo and how well we were doing touring with these big acts and stuff. And when I couldn't play anymore, it made it that much worse. My self-worth really suffered. You know, I was like, who am I anymore? Everybody that thought I was just a punk kid had come around to thinking, oh, well, you know, Boo is such a good musician and he's doing this and he's doing all these big things. And I felt like I'd made it up to my parents, you know, and proved everybody wrong. And then it was like, nope, you're just a nobody again. And that was part of the tailspin that I really suffered from, is coming to accept that, hey, you're worthy just as who you are. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be this, you know, rock star making millions to be that. And fortunately, I had I went back to college because we'd all dropped out of college, and I landed this amazing internship with a day trading firm that was doing unbelievably cutting edge stuff. And they gave me a chance, and I started to come back just because I had this new challenge in front of me. But the one thing that was missing was my creative outlet. And so that's when I started to play guitar and started to get the wine bug, and also said, I'm going to start writing. And as soon as I really started writing, boy, that was the bug that got me the most. And it was almost a second full-time job from the moment I started taking it seriously. I would get home and write. I'd wake up really early and write. I read every single crap book there was. And of course, Stephen King and a million other authors' advice is read as many novels as you can. So I was doing that. And it's been pretty much that way ever since, until I left my day job and was doing this full time.
Well, I think you said that you read something good and then you write. You read something that inspires you and then you do your own writing.
Yeah, totally. I love just not to copy other authors, but I love being inspired by what they're doing and being reminded that you can write and be as brave as you possibly want to, because, you know, even Nelson DeMille will write stuff and I'm like, oh my God, that's just, it's almost, you need a license to have that much fun. You know, it feels like illegal to have that much fun. And that's what I love. You know, just, I'll read something and just think, okay, I am reminded that I can write whatever I want to, and people are going to allow it probably, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's what makes writing exciting, is that there are really no bounds. There's no, you can do whatever. It's the one place where you can live extremely dangerously without the fear of death or injury.
Yeah, so, totally. And I can't.
Might have to scale back at some point, but that's okay because it's simple enough to do. I always tell people it's never the problem of, I have too much imagination. It's always the problem of, I'm not allowing myself to imagine. I'm trying to sound like a novelist. I'm trying to sound like every other book that's out there instead of breaking new ground or taking some real risks.
Yes, exactly. And I always wish maybe one day somebody can remind me what the quote was. And I want to say it's Charles Bukowski, but it was something along the lines of you need to write without thinking about your mother reading it or your parents reading it. And I really find myself catching myself and going, honey, you know, is this too much or something? Then just let the editor take that out if it's going to really be a problem. But when you're writing, you got to get out the deepest, darkest, you know, whatever it is, just say it, put it on the page, because that's the stuff that's, you know, typically really interesting. I mean, I try to be that way talking too.
Yeah, well, and there's not actually very many authors out there who do that. I mean, I think of a guy like Tom Robbins and a book like, you know, Another Roadside Attraction or even Cowgirls Get the Blues or Half Asleep in Frog Pajamas. You can read something like that and it's like, wow, this guy is out there. But there's very few writers who actually do that.
Yeah,
so there's not, you have to really search.
There was a book, you know, and he's a different beast. But Andrew Dubois, House of Sand and Fog, which is one of my best ever. And
that's on your list. That made a great movie, too.
It did. Yeah, one of the few conversions that worked well. But boy, does he write without a care in the world for who's going to be reading it. I mean, that is cut from his soul. And I adored it. And, you know, that's what I would like to be. And it amazes me to this day. I mean, my book just hit number 28 in the Kindle store this morning. And I'm amazed that I was allowed to write some of the stuff in there that I did, because I really got sensitive and opened up and like cut into the core of who I was. And I'd like to think that's why it's succeeding, but it's scary. It's like taking your clothes off and walking out your front door, you know?
You know, you say that you write the first 100 pages and then you run it past your beta reader. So you do have some people reviewing it. Is your wife a beta reader? Do you have a few different people? And what are you looking for from a beta reader who's looking at your first 100 pages?
Sure. So my wife is what I would call an alpha reader. I don't know if that counts or not, but she's the one who reads it even before my agent, because she's the one who will catch something that I wrote that's like, hey, you're going to upset people, or this is just people won't like you if they read this, or, you know, whatever. And then my agent will read the first 50 or so. My agent is also an editor for Katherine Ryan Hyde and tons of big authors. So I have the best agent in the world because she does both really well. And she helps me get on track, like with my character with the singing trees. I had written kind of a character not like who I was, which she was kind of soft and impressionable. And we started talking and she was like, I'm seeing this character as more rebellious, like you were growing up. And as soon as I did that, I was plugged into this woman and knew exactly how to write her. So that's where my agent comes in. And then I have a beta reading team who I wait typically till I have half the book or the whole book, a draft. And I've been building them for years and I've got probably 30 that have worked on me for 6 or 7 books. And slowly, if a reader writes and says, hey, I'm a beta reader and would love to be involved, or if a reader writes and I can tell by what they write that they're, you know, cut out for it by the nature of how they're critiquing my writing or complimenting it or whatever, I'll add them to it. And I'm really proud of my beta reading team and my interaction with them. We have a Facebook group and I'll send them a draft and then a bunch of questions, because I find if you don't send questions, they don't really know how to help. But I'll include 20, 30, 40 questions and I'll say, just help me how you can. Answer the questions or give me 2 sentences of the problems or why it's working, why it's not, anything. And then typically if there is a more than one opinion, especially if there's a majority opinion of I don't understand why this character did this, then I'll know I have a problem. Now, if it's only one person, then I've really got to question whether, you know, this is a systemic problem or this is just one reader that was bothered for some reason. But I can't even tell you how much they help my writing. It's just unbelievable.
Interesting. Interesting. So two guys walk in a bar. One guy's name is Boo Walker. The other guy's name is Benjamin Blackmore. What does Boo Walker do vis-a-vis Benjamin Blackmore? How would they behave differently? Are they one and the same, or is Boo Walker going to savor a glass of Sangiovese while Benjamin Blackmore starts a bar brawl?
Right, exactly. I think Benjamin Blackmore orders a cold craft local beer, and Boo Walker asks what kind of stemware they have, and if they've got the right stemware, then he'll have a glass of Old World light chilled red wine, and if not, then he'll probably just get a beer.
And then personality wise, are you guys identical, or other than the beverage,
that's a great question.
Identical, or is one of you edgier than the other? Is one more contemplative and the other one's more brassy, maybe?
Yeah, I can answer it perfectly because I experienced this when I was writing my latest novel. The first draft, the first 100 pages came out, and the character had quite a bit of an anger issue. And my agent immediately said, this is just not going to work. This is a thriller. And I realized that, like you said, Benjamin Blackmore and my thrillers, I allow this angry, edgy side of me to come out that I typically don't really let sneak into my Boo Walker stuff. That's more my sensitive side.
Boo Walker, thank you for coming on the program.
My pleasure. What great questions. That was a ton of fun.